Please be seated. The preacher, especially if he or she has some time in the pulpit, or the metaphorical pulpit, the aisle, has some time served, the preacher knows long before the sermon is preached whether it will be smooth or turbulent. And I have, as only a male preacher can do, I have in my mind, in my own private thoughts, oftentimes referred to sermons as like labor, like either this will be an easy labor or a hard labor. And this is going to be a hard one. There are times when I, as a preacher, have begun my sermon saying, like, buckle your seatbelt. This idea that we might need something that would restrain or constrain us in order to listen to a sermon and to try to follow the thought or the feeling that it embodies. And if I were to do that today, I would say, like, rather than the typical three-point harness that we have in our vehicles that we drive around, we're probably going to need that, like, six-point harness that they have in race cars. So bear with me as I seek to engage these stories and this thought and our experience as people who are seeking to live out a faith in 2025. Humanity, since the very beginning of time, has had a curious relationship with this concept that we call creativity. And since teachers and commentators and writers and bards and poets and painters have been narrating the human experience, there have been people who have engaged the topic of creativity and humanity's relationship to it, seeking to define the experience for us creatures, us human beings. We might remember from our 10th grade Western Civ class or from our junior year of college philosophy class, Aristotle's work, particularly in Poetics, where he talks about mimesis, this intersection that humanity has with creative expression. Aristotle seeks to explain that relationship through this model that art and creativity is reflective of the human experience. And it's a bit beyond reflection. It's something a little bit more than a mirroring that happens, but that art or creativity itself is drawing us out to the could or the shoulds in the life of the human experience. It is in Aristotle's writing where there is that proverbial wisdom derived of art imitates life. And then if we were to fast forward 2,300 years in advance and we were to take a look at the thought and art of playwright, poet, author Oscar Wilde, Wilde does a bit of a reverse on Aristotle and writes in an essay, "It is life that imitates art far more than art imitates life." And then if we were to go all the way backwards 200 or 300 years before Aristotle's writing into our own tradition, we would hear the Jewish priests and the Jewish theologians first craft the most beautiful first poem and then story that comes out of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, that is descriptive of the primary activity that God expresses within the cosmos. And that primary activity, the very first thing that God does in our poem, that first poem, and in that story, that second story, is to be creative. The poem describes God hovering over chaos. Tehom is the Hebrew word. And that God begins to creatively bring order to chaos. And that in each act of that creativity, there is goodness that is brought into reality, into the creation of the cosmos itself, into the very beginning of all creatures that inhabit the earth or the sea or the sky. And then finally, in that last seventh beat of the poem, into the experience of humanity itself. We, as human beings, have an ongoing, built-in, generative, empowering, reproductive relationship with creativity, whether we acknowledge it or not. Somewhat ironically, we access this content we learn from Aristotle or Wilde or even from the Jewish priests and theologians. We learn about this relationship and this commentary through higher education. Maybe it began in Sunday school as little kids when we first began engaging that creation story. Maybe it began in elementary school or middle school or high school when we began to engage that first thought of Western philosophy. Maybe it began in undergraduate educational circles when we engaged the thought of creative writers and thinkers, iconoclasts like Oscar Wilde, or perhaps if you were doomed to the great privilege that I was doomed to, you engaged those concepts in graduate school when you wrestled with the thoughts of the earliest Israelite thinkers and poets and philosophers and clergy. Nevertheless, we find ourselves at a particularly curious intersection as Western thinkers, where for over the course of more than 100 years, we have been drawn to and led to and taught toward understanding our existence, our existential realities, and if our existential realities, then most certainly how we engage our faith from the point of view that we do it with our minds. We have been led to believe that the work of both an educated human being and the work of the faithful Christian is to take the tradition and the sacred story and all of the commentary and to make sense of it. And so far, so bad, right? Because there are aspects of our experience when it comes to engaging life and all the subsequent stories that surround us, the stories of the saints who have gone before us, those teachers and commentators, those stories of those of us who live in this very present moment, one with another in relationship, to one another, and most assuredly those who will come long, long after us, if we are trying only to make sense of this tradition and these stories, then we will most assuredly fail. Because how could it be that a loving God would build both great joy and dark sorrow into a life where those things are braided together and inseparable? It just doesn't make sense. And so then we have to ask ourselves, like, existentially, then what are we meant to make? What are we meant to make if we're not meant to make sense of things? And we have this wonderful story from the Hebrew Scriptures this morning, or I should say, somewhat humorously, we have a portion of a wonderful story from the Hebrew Scriptures today. If you look at your bulletin right now, what you will see is like a thoroughly curious passage that we have from Daniel, from the prophecy of Daniel, where there's a missing section in there. And there is a missing section in there because the people who put this thing together called the lectionary, this calendar of readings, they think their job is to make sense of the Bible. And so they leave out this curious and utterly creative and imaginative portion of Daniel's dream, Daniel's vision itself. It is one of the most creative and dynamic visions across the entirety of the biblical narrative. It begins with Daniel saying that he has a dream, and not just like a sleeping dream, but it's a vision. It's one that Daniel is embodying. And the text that you heard read says, like, Daniel encounters four beasts. And then, like, we just skip it. It doesn't explain these incredibly creative characters that Daniel encounters in his vision. The first one is a lion with wings of an eagle comes onto the scene. And as that lion enters the scene with his eagle's wings, those wings are plucked off the lion, and the lion is stood up like a human being. And then the second creature that Daniel engages is a bear, not like a teddy bear, like a scary bear. And in the teeth of this scary bear, depending upon the translation that you read, the bear has in its teeth either three rib bones or three tusks. And then the third creature that we engage is a panther or a jaguar or a leopard. And that leopard has four sets of wings, but somewhat comedically, the wings are not like the wings of a raptor. They're like four sets of sparrow wings. And the panther has four heads. And then the ultimate creature that Daniel envisions is something that is just utterly imaginary. The story narrates that this creature has teeth of iron and 10 horns. And as this iron-toothed, 10-horned creature comes into Daniel's view in this experience of this mystical or psychedelic vision that he's having, the creature somehow grows three more horns and 10 sets of eyes. It is a fantastic and beautiful and enlivening and awfully fun, if not somewhat terrifying, vision. And then the interpretation of the story that Daniel is given is that these four beasts, they represent kings, or they represent governments, governments that rule with power and power that leads to violence and to domination. And then Daniel sees something at the end of his vision. He sees what we call like the Son of Man or the Son of Humanity comes on the scene. And the Son of Humanity is a more powerful ruler than any of those fantastic beasts ever are. We are meant to see the person Jesus. We are also meant to see little old you and little old me. That's how the incarnation works. It is a dynamic and beautiful piece of writing that is meant to move us and engage an aspect of our incarnation in a way that we aren't normally moved when we're just trying to make sense of things. Mystics like Daniel and literature like we get from the prophecy of Daniel, apocalyptic literature is the brand of literature that Daniel embodies, are seeking to call us out. Apocalypse, you know, as like a Cold War kid, I mean, I was 10 years old in 1980, and we were all afraid of like thermonuclear war. And so apocalypse to us Americans in these days means like the destruction of the planet, most likely through nuclear war, where all creatures are killed. And in fact, perhaps the planet itself is destroyed completely. That's not what this genre of literature was addressing in its early forms, even through today to the mystics who write today. Apocalypse just simply means a revealing, an unshrouding, an uncovering, enlightening of a concept. And what we get if we're paying careful attention to the apocalyptic writers, which, by the way, makes like any of this apocalyptic liturgy, just does not make sense at all. It so much doesn't make sense that the people who build our lectionary don't even include it. They're like, oh, skip that part. Like, yeah, just cut that out. Like, do the Thomas Jefferson thing on that part of the Bible, right? So, apocalyptic writers or Jewish priests and theologians, or Irish playwright poets, or Greek philosophers are trying with their thought to draw us in to a deeper experience of what it means to be a human being. And doing that over and against a reflection of art or the power of creativity itself, what we experience, if we're not just trying to make sense of things, but we're really trying to make meaning with things, what we're meant to experience is that we human beings, we have agency here. We have power here. We have vocation here. We are being called into something big and something beautiful, something that when we only access the mind leaves that work to God. But when we access the story itself, we find very quickly that that work is not just God's work, but it is also the work of humanity. That's where we get this beautiful nativity story within the context of the Christian faith. It's a crazy, somewhat apocalyptic story that we get. Remember the story itself, not from like, you know, the like fairy tale that we tell on Christmas Eve when the snow is gently falling and the kids are here dressed up as sheep and angels and wise people from afar. I don't denigrate that experience. I love it. But I am here to tell you this morning that that is not the trajectory of the narrative itself. The trajectory of the narrative itself is narrating utter chaos. A family in the last trimester of the last trimester is forced out of their home in order to be sequestered in a place so that a domineering foreign government might count them, might write their name on a list and know where they live and who they belong to. And in this displaced experience, those particular refugees come into Bethlehem at a time where there was such great chaos that there was nowhere, not even a Red Cross shelter set up in a school gymnasium where a pregnant woman could lay her head. She was forced to go into the shack behind the farmhouse to give birth to a baby. And oh, by the way, the animals are there, not like sheep gently resting at side and cows mooing and donkeys braying. I mean, farmland chaos. The story itself, that's the last place anyone wants to give birth to a child. It is utterly chaotic. It is a horrific scene. And then just to make the scene a little more horrific, so horrific that it becomes somewhat comedic, ding dong, we have house guests. People have come to pay you a visit when you are at your absolute lowest point ever. Oh, and two groups of people. The first group of people is like a bunch of working class blue collar dudes. We get a whole group of sheep ranchers who show up because an angel told them to come see your baby. And then on the other side, from the other side of the cultural, socioeconomic spectrum, ding dong, we get a bunch of foreign dignitaries, ambassadors, who, by the way, don't share your language and don't share your culture, who show up with some baby gifts on hand. Why? Because a star told them to come see your baby. This is the moment that Jesus is born into, the experience that Jesus is born to. This is the apocalypse, the revealing of the calling and the vocation and the empowerment of each human being. Because each of us is born, maybe not into the exaggerated chaos of the manger, but each of us is born into this experience of like, things just don't make sense. And there are aspects of our incarnation, aspects of our existence that are so terrifyingly humbling, or also aspects of our existence that shine so brightly beautiful that in relationship to the terrifying, humbling experiences, make no sense of all at all. So then we have to ask ourselves, as human beings, then what then is our work? What then is our vocation? What is our job? What is the cosmos? What is God herself, himself, inviting us into in our own incarnations? And what we learn at each beat, if we abandon the work of trying to make sense of things and we engage in the art of creativity, what we find is that you and I, every single one of us, every single person sitting in this church is being called either quietly or quite loudly to join in to the reordering of chaos, to the bringing forward of truth and goodness and beauty and love into the very experience of humanity and creation itself, wherever we live. That is our job. It's not our job as faithful people. It's not our job as disciples to make sense of things. You know, Episcopalians try to do it every single Sunday, right after the sermon, when we read the creed, as if we were going to make sense of what is in the Nicene Creed. The Nicene Creed is not a list of things for us to believe. It is a palette from which we dip our brush and begin to paint a lovingly beautiful, a lovingly kind, an empowered, glorious, true, and good existence for all of us and every other creature in creation. This is a tall order, one that we will fail at again and again and again. But who cares? Who cares if we fail? It is our calling. It is our vocation. And we are meant to pick up the work of making meaning and abandon the work of making sense of the chaos and disorder that we encounter. Ironically, I ask you to stop trying to make sense of the faith in probably one of the most like conceptual sermons I've ever preached. Let me just say one last thing. One last thing to all of you saints on All Saints Day, and acknowledging the good work that all of these saints and everyone who came before them and all of the saints who will come after us. Let me say just one last thing. Church, saints, individually and collectively, we have work to do. I know that you know that. Let me say another thing. Church, saints, individually and collectively, we have work to do. And somewhat gloriously, somewhat curiously, and making no sense out of it all, you sit within a context of a church during a time when churches are lost and burning. You sit in the context of a church for whatever reason, who knows. You sit in the context of a church that wants to do this work. I know that somewhere, some heart in this church this morning is warming. You are sitting among other warm hearts. I am asking you, I am inviting you, I am begging you to bring forward your most creative ideas. Most assuredly, many of them will fail, right? But if you are thinking of any idea right now about some little thing or some medium-sized thing or some big thing that might bring a little bit more love into the community of Jackson Hole or the community of Wyoming or the community of the United States of America or the community of the world itself, if there is any small, medium-sized, or big idea that you have, please, please bring it. Bring it. Let's fail at it rather than trying to make sense of it, right? Let's come together in a more deliberate way and engage one another across all of our myriad of differences, across all the chaos that we are experiencing right now. Let's come together and reorder this world so that we might live with and in, and others might live with and in, the love that we are built to live in and with. That's all I have for you this morning. So be it.